As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Premier League Round 8. A bad weekend for our insect friends, the Bees at Brentford, Hornets with Liverpool and Anton Deck at St James's. We'll be running up all of the big stories, saying mashallah to Mo Salah and yes to Leicester against Man United, and looking ahead to midweek delights like Man United against Atalanta and the Foxes at Spartak Moscow. All that plus more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello there, listener. Monday the 18th of October, of course. And assembled here, I'm quite frankly raring to go. We've got Daniel Story, Adrian Clark and Sasha Gurionov. Hello.
Morning, James. Hello.
Good morning.
Hey, Sash. Mike Ashley, not the only man on his bike this weekend, eh?
Yeah, but I had to stop halfway through because I got a flat. So then I had to get a train and walk part of the way. So just the 25 miles along the Grand Union Canal, which I don't really recommend for cycling because it is quite bumpy. No wonder I got a flat. Thankfully, not before I got to Vicarage Road.
Right. Yeah. No, so listener, this was Sasha's kind of Saturday, super cycling Saturday pilgrimage to, first of all, Vicarage Road for Watford, Liverpool. And then, so did you not take your bike back down to Brentford, to the Brentford?
No, I dragged it on the Overland. Overland, thankfully, takes
bikes.
Oh,
that's disappointing. Mm. Right. But a good day?
Oh, it's a beautiful day. Saw some, well, the first game really didn't work out to be much of a contest, but a few stunning things done by Liverpool, which we'll go into. Mm. And of course, in the evening, Brentford Community Stadium does it again. I mean, every time I go there, something brilliant happens in those last 20 minutes. Chelsea were so, so lucky. And, of course, indebted to Mendy.
Right. And you managed to work in a Napoleon reference as well. So we'll...
Yeah, I think somebody got tricked.
Right. Okay. We'll get on to all of that very shortly. The usual check on the scores, though, to get things underway. Round 8 of the season. Liverpool kicking the weekend off, as Sasha mentioned, welcoming Claudio Ranieri back. With a nice early doors reducer, 5-0 the victory. Elsewhere, Saints got their first win, 1-0 against Leeds. Norwich, though, are still looking for theirs. They finished goalless with Brighton. Burnley also still looking for a first win, although they did only lose 2-0 this time at Man City, which is something. Wolves pulled off the comeback of the weekend from 2-0 down with 10 minutes to go to 3-2 winners in their kind of derby with Villa, while Chelsea won 1-0 at Brentford despite that late barrage from the Bees. And Leicester finally ended Man United's long unbeaten away run and their own slump with a 4-2 win at the King Power. Sunday, West Ham won the David Moyes derby with Everton. And Newcastle Spurs was a bit mad. We'll get onto that very shortly. Arsenal Palace is Monday night, and Adrian's going along to that. But our man at St James's Park yesterday, Sunday, was Daniel Story for Newcastle against Spurs.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Daniel, there's a lot, of course, to discuss from this game. Let's just start with the kind of pre-game atmosphere. I loved your description of the hazy disbelief that the cloud of Mike Ashley had lifted, like walking out of a dark cinema and feeling a little disorientated by the sunlight.
Yeah, it was a very, very strange atmosphere. I arrived in Newcastle expecting it to be a kind of outpouring of joy and celebration. And to an extent that happened in the stadium, but outside the ground, it didn't really feel like that. It felt, and this might be me projecting my own opinions onto Newcastle supporters, but it felt like there were a lot of fans who were a bit unsure of just how much they were expected to celebrate and very aware of the fact that celebrating an owner leaving looks an awful lot like celebrating a soft power takeover of your club. There were a number of fans who were in Saudi fancy dress. To be honest, most of them looked as if they were doing it to try and get on TV. And most of them did get on TV or various Instagram accounts by doing it. But actually, there were a lot of supporters around them kind of tutting under their breath and using multiple curse words to describe that kind of sort of embarrassing reaction, I think. I mean, when the chairman was announced over the PA system, there was a huge celebration, but I kind of guess that's inevitable. You know, there was never going to be anything else for that, because a lot of fans cannot separate the arrival of Yasir Al-Rayyan as chairman and the Saudis as owners with Mike Ashley leaving. But yeah, it felt odd. It really did. It was an incredibly weird afternoon, as you say, for various reasons.
Well, if it wasn't quite a stag do atmosphere before the game, though, a couple of minutes in when Callum Wilson opened the scoring, that did get a bit lively.
Yeah, it did. And basically, I mean, the first 10 minutes were exactly as I expected the whole game to be, which is Newcastle to be massively up for it. The unfortunate thing for Newcastle is that after 15 minutes, Tottenham realised that Newcastle don't really press you in possession and give you a heck of a lot of space in the final third, and therefore their players are better than Newcastle's players. And the rest of the game was embarrassingly one-sided until Eric Dier's own goal. I mean, it's all very... I wrote in my piece that until now, Newcastle are kind of only celebrating this kind of concept or this vague idea of being good again. But they aren't very good now. In fact, they're awful now. I think they're probably the worst team in the Premier League on current form and in terms of showing any sort of backbone. And Bruce is going to be sacked this week. I was surprised it didn't happen last week, but I understand they want to get a director of football in to play a part in that role, and that has to come first. And the takeover was very hastily put through, which didn't allow them to do that initially. But at the moment, they look doomed if they don't sort that very quickly.
Right. They've slipped to 19th place. So you think they'll get the director of football in the course of this week in time to appoint a new manager before their trip to Palace next weekend?
I think last week they didn't do it. The option was to make Graham Jones the caretaker and sack Bruce. That didn't happen last week. If they're not able to get a director of football in this week, I think they might have to do that, even if they didn't want to last week, because the performance was so abject and the chance in the second half about wanting Bruce out was so... It was both sets of fans. It was Spurs fans starting it as a kind of crowing, and then Newcastle fans responding by going, yeah, you're only singing what we're thinking as well, so we'll join in. And that can't continue for another week, because if they're not careful, the mood sours at the time when they need it to stay as buoyant as possible.
Let's talk about Spurs then, because this was quite the return to form, albeit against a fairly abject, from the side of it, at Newcastle. And Harry Kane getting not only his first Premier League goal, but also an assist for the Sun goal, which came after that 25-minute suspension. We can touch on that as well, because that, I'm sure, played a part in the way the mood changed at St James's Park. But what about Spurs' performance?
Yeah, I thought it was an excellent Spurs performance. Daniel touched on it. Newcastle make it incredibly easy for good footballing teams to play. They've got no pace at the back, so they drop off, which creates an enormous amount of space for Son, for Moura, for Kane to wreak havoc alongside Ndombele, of course. And Spurs just made hay. It was ridiculously easy. I thought the goal that Kane scored kind of summed up how bad Newcastle are at the back. Not one member of the back four was communicating. Not one member of the back four looked to see where Spurs' main goal threat was. And he just snuck up behind them with that arced run. And it was a great goal. Lovely pass from Højbjerg and a beautiful lifted finish from Kane. So no, I think lots to like about the Spurs' performance. I'm still very sceptical about the the Dier Romero axis at the back. I think that needs to improve a lot moving forwards. But yeah, this was comfy for Spurs. And I think if they'd have pushed it, they could have won more handsomely.
Mm. Most surprising stat of the weekend is that Spurs are actually fifth in the table. Only goal difference off the Champions League places. Hang on, weren't they in total crisis last time I looked?
Well, maybe sometimes it helps playing nice opposition like this and maybe playing themselves into form. Maybe Kane playing himself into maybe his more natural position, because I think in this game here, he didn't really have to drop because Ndombele did all the job around there. They didn't really need Kane deeper, I think, so he could stay higher up. I think overall, if you look at it, I think particularly after the stoppage for the fan, I'm sure we'll get onto that. That last spell of the first half that they finished playing, I thought, like at that stage, like Newcastle players were completely absent, so that Spurs could get the third goal where they really nicely just played through them without really much pressure at all. And then second half was just a procession. And I think for Spurs, given the situation, like, you know, three wins, three defeats, this was probably the perfect opposition. And also from Newcastle's point of view, takeovers and stuff, they still need to get to January. Looking at this and potentially a lot of the squad quite demotivated. Again, if you leave the things 1 or 2 weeks further, I think questions will be asked, do the owners know what they're doing? And, you know, I have to question this because, yes, this takeover was hasty. Well, it came through sort of quite quickly, but it's not like they didn't really have time to prepare for it once it eventually does come through. So I think overall, Newcastle, I think, are currently in a very curious position. And you know what? If things start going wrong, there isn't going to be much sympathy for them around the country.
Crikey. Well, the suspension that we mentioned came after a supporter was taken ill and a couple of Spurs players realised this quickly. How did that happen, actually, Daniel?
Yeah, so Spurs won a corner on the right, and initially there was all sort of waving from fans, which my initial instinct reaction was that they were moaning about the ball not being in the quadrant because it was that kind of waving of arms thing. But then you realise that it was happening on the opposite side of the pitch to the corner, and so something completely different was happening. And yeah, Sergio Reguilón spotted it, Eric Dier spotted it. Dier sprinted over to the bench to try and get some medical attention. I think there was a little bit of confusion about that. I think they were asking for medical help, and actually what they needed was a defibrillator straight away, and thankfully that happened quickly enough. But we should say, not only did the players react brilliantly, but there was two guys, there was a lady in the stand where the incident happened, who started CPR immediately. And then there's a guy in the Gallagher end who ran sort of a quarter of the way around the ground across the pitch, who is an A&E registered doctor in Newcastle, who then administered some CPR. And, you know, they literally saved the guy's life by the sound of it, because within 20 minutes we were being told by Newcastle's press officer that they were stabilised, leaving the ground, and were going to hospital. And then last night we got another update to say that they were kind of awake and recovering, which is, if I'm honest, is not how it felt at the time. It felt that we were in a really grave situation, because just the length of the stoppage and the reaction of the players as they came over to the dugouts was really grim. Mm.
Well, excellent work then by everyone involved, and in some ways how fortunate that it happened at a football match where defibrillators
there's an organisation called Northeast Defibs who I think only last year had 6 defibrillators installed in St James's. I mean, there's no excuse for that not to be the case at every football ground in the country and right down to grassroots level given the funding. But yeah, you're absolutely right, there's almost no safer place for something like that to happen than a Premier League football match, which is bizarre, but in this incident, kind of all's well that ends well, hopefully.
Mm, indeed so. All right, well, that game ended particularly well for Spurs, although, as you mentioned, there was that mad Eric Dier own goal to make the scoreline a slightly more respectable 3-2 for the home side. Newcastle, by that point, were down to 10 men after John Joe Shelvey's kind of rumbustious cameo. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think whatever happens at Newcastle, and Sasha, I think, is right to be a little bit more circumspect this morning. But I think in the next 5 years, there will be better options as game-changing substitutes than John Joe Shelvey at St James's Park. I mean, the two identical challenges in different areas of the pitch. And I mean, the whole ground watches that second booking, sees it coming 5 seconds away and thinks, you know you've already been booked. You're not going to do this, are you? Yeah, you are going to. Oh, you have done it, and you have been sent off, yes.
Yeah. He's been doing this in his entire career. It's utterly bizarre. Just the behaviour hasn't changed since his time at like Swansea and Liverpool, and he just, yeah, over and over, John Joe Shelvey.
Footballers are supposed to mature, aren't they? But John Joe Shelvey seems to regress in that particular category. I'd say that Shelvey was one of the most ill-disciplined players of his generation. It's just, he'll always let you down, won't he? And he'll be one of 15 to 20 players, I think, to leave over the course of the next 18 months. They have to. Without Saint-Maximin and Callum Wilson, Newcastle are playoff contenders in the Championship. That's what they are. That's their level.
Wow. Well, the future could be bright or not. We shall see for Newcastle. Plenty to sort out then for them. On Sunday, the other game, a little bit earlier, saw West Ham go to Goodison Park and win 1-0 at Everton. Cracking result for the Hammers, given Everton had won all their home matches prior to this.
My man Solomon Rondon is currently letting me down, not really leading the line particularly well in Dominic Calvert-Lewin's absence. I had a couple of presentable headed chances which he didn't take, but yeah, I think overall, only one team really played football, and that team was David Moyes' West Ham United, and who looked like a more of a football team. But I think Everton, yeah, I think you have to appreciate the fact they were missing not only Calvert-Lewin, but also Richarlison, and I think that really blunted the way like they looked going forward, but also didn't help the way they conceded the goal. I think that was quite wobbly defending from Pickford, possibly on both occasions. But I think overall, this is exactly the sort of game and sort of result which I will then observe over the next few days to gauge the atmosphere and the fans' feelings towards Rafael Benitez.
Hmm. Really interested in what Sasha said there about only one team playing football, because one thing I've got on my notes in front of me is Everton need to start playing football. That is the obvious thing. It's great to have a philosophy. It's the clearly Rafa wants to create an identity where they're a really dangerous counter-attacking side, and they are. They really are, and we've seen that particularly away from home this season in the absence of some really, really good players. But when Dominic Calvert-Lewin is fit again, they need to play inside the opposition half and put balls into the box for him. And to do that, they need to string some passes together. And Everton are not passing the ball. They're not mixing their game up at all. If you look at sequences of passes, 10 or more. Okay, so 10 or more passes is a relatively long sequence, but nothing amazing. They've made 27 this season, which is the second lowest in the Premier League in front of Burnley. Everton have made 27. Just to put this into context, Brighton have made 123. So that is quite the stark difference in terms of style. I just think they're a little bit better than just being a counter-attacking team. They've got some good footballers. They need to maybe control matches with more confidence in the way that West Ham did here. It was really accomplished from them.
Quick word for Declan Rice, who seems to be having one of those starts of the season where every opposition fan who's just watched him then immediately takes to social media and says, yeah, I don't think I'd realise quite how good Declan Rice was. Which, you know, coming off a long summer at the Euros with a lot of responsibility in a position in West Ham's team when there's a lot of responsibility and clearly replacing Mark Noble, he's just going up and up and up. And, you know, that he will inevitably be linked to bigger clubs. But, you know, it would have been very easy for his form to slip off at the start of this season, I think, for reasons of energy and transfer rumours. But he just looks absolutely brilliant. And he was the game's best player again, I think.
Mm. West Ham on their way to becoming a pretty big club there under David Moyes. That's what happened on Sunday. Next up, let's get on to the big headlines from Saturday.
So, Mr. Klopp, what's been troubling you?
Well, it's a very important time of the year, and I'm worried we're not going to be able to get the most out of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of big games coming up.
Games? No, I'm talking about Oktoberfest. Sauerkraut, Steins, Lederhosen, the one time Germany comes to England, yeah.
Sometimes it can seem like they don't know what they're doing, but with Paddy Power, you always know you're getting Das Beste rewards, like money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Paddy Power!
Pretty much bet builder bets only. Min odds 1 to 5 per leg. Min 4 plus legs. Max free bet £10 per day. Excludes enhanced match odds. Online exclusive T's and C's apply. 18 plus. Become aware.org.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Saturday saw the big sides, you know, your Manchester Cities, your Liverpools, etc., all winning with one exception. Them again. Tom Williams here with one of the tweets of the weekend. Solskjaer needs to concentrate on his football. Very nice. We'll get on to Man United's trip to the King Power very shortly. Firstly, though, Sasha, part one of your bike trip that wasn't saw you take in Watford's clash with Liverpool and that goal.
Salah with a chance. Wonderful feat, brilliant play. Here he goes, Salah. Oh, what about that? Oh, my word! That was sensational!
Oh, my word.
Woof. Mo Salah there with his latest goal of the season contender in Liverpool's 5-0 win at Vicarage Road, having already, Sasha, contributed an assist of the season contender for Sadio Mane's opener, no?
Yeah, I mean, Salah in this form. I think when I came on the pod 3 weeks ago, I was like, yeah, Salah's great. And since then, he's just started, kept on doing phenomenal things. So I think he's scored now in 8 games in a row, and he hasn't just scored. As you mentioned, he assisted, obviously beautifully, against Manchester City as well. But here, in the opening minutes against, you know, Watford are the type of club, they always seem to get the new manager bounce. Maybe that's how they keep themselves going and recharging. And here, I think that just finished them because there is a few things about that goal, not just the Salah pass, but also the way that Joel Matip stepped out to win the header, to really like establish himself. The Liverpool defence played in the front foot. There was effectively 5 players attacking at any one time. And there was a spell after the first goal when, you know, not much seemed to happen, but Liverpool just completely wore out Watford and then just effectively finished them off. And I think this was interesting because on the one hand, you have classy players, then they're hardworking, then they're also missing some players, but everything came together. Maybe Klopp also instilled a bit of that siege mentality beforehand. He was complaining about quite a few things before the game on the Friday and before the game in the morning as well. But they came out and they played like a team with a point to prove. Perhaps the 3-0 from 2020 was still at the back of their minds. And that was very, very painful. But here's the thing. Liverpool improved since then, whereas Watford lost Doucouré, Kapu, Hughes, Deeney. That spine is gone. So they've looked like a team that wasn't gnarly, that didn't have much experience, that didn't have anyone to effectively to knock a few heads together when things aren't going right. But they also looked like a team who were effectively undercoached, because I think it was weird to see Ranieri go with 5 or like with 4.5 at the back, because that's not his usual system. There was a lot of gaps that Liverpool exploited ruthlessly. Poor old Danny Rose up against Salah and Trent Alexander-Arnold, all my days. So I think it's the Salah goal. When he did that shimmy to get past 3 players, I didn't really understand what happened. But what sticks in my mind, because I was sitting in the line of the shot up in the main stand in Elton John stand, and for a moment, all I could see was effectively everybody going the wrong way and Salah just having this tunnel in front of him to put the ball into. And this is the image I have, Cathcart's on the floor. And you could see the players, the Watford players' weight was just basically the wrong way, and they just left the goal open for him and he put it away, and it's just phenomenal. I mean, Adrian, obviously you play professional football. You are so much better than like 99.99% of the population. And then there is a guy that's so much better than everyone else. Yeah. And it just must be extraordinary. Like someone like Cathcart. Cathcart's what, 33? Excellent professional, plays Premier League football. And then Salah just makes him look quite silly.
It was extraordinary. Yeah, the way that sort of double drag back with the ball underneath his studs, it just created this enormous collective flinch, didn't it? Where everyone went, oh, like that, and then he was just away. It was remarkable, magical to watch. And yeah, I mean, he's just operating Mo Salah at the moment in this kind of special, untouchable, Messi-esque zone, isn't he? He's just in that zone. And yeah, it's wonderful to watch. The 2 goals that he scored, just the one against City as well, just sensational.
So this season, things have kicked up a notch again from Mo Salah. Is that fair? Why would that be, do you think?
I think that Liverpool are being more assertive full stop. Remember, they didn't have any centre-backs last year, so they didn't defend on the front foot in the way that they like to. So they're winning the ball earlier and therefore releasing their best attackers much sooner. And if you can release your attackers sooner, it gives them a bit, buys them a bit more space. Van Dijk going from back to front early before opposition defenders are set has changed things. Whereas before, teams could just get everyone behind the ball, block off those spaces. They're just doing everything quicker. But he personally is just, yeah, he's in the zone. It's a hard to quantify how you get there, but he's there, and it's just joyous for us all to watch.
All right, quote here from Daniel Storey in his excellent The Score roundup in the I newspaper. No player in the Premier League is able to go from serenity to causing maximum danger more quickly. He excels most at finding pockets of unguarded space, staying quiet like a child, desperately hoping the adults at the party won't notice them and pat them off to bed. And then Daniel, boom.
Yeah, I mean, my big takeaway from the weekend is that he is now a brilliant goal against Man United or Brighton away from doing a Dennis Bergkamp and being top three in goal of the month. Bergkamp famously did that with his Leicester. Was it his Leicester hat-trick, I guess? Mm-hmm. So, yes, they are remarkably similar. But then that's the point with Mo Salah. It's not that you don't know what he's going to do. It's that you do know what he's going to do and you can't do anything to stop it, which is ridiculous.
Right. And as you say, Man United coming up next weekend. What's the situation, by the way, regarding Mo Salah's contract?
Well, Sasha will know, but it's ticking down and... Everyone at Liverpool is most pleased by this form, not just because it's taking Liverpool to another title challenge, but because it's hopefully making that decision a no-brainer that he wants a level of pay which will make him the best player at Liverpool, but he's also arguably the best player at Liverpool. There's no agreement yet, and let's face it, there will be no shortage of clubs to come in for him. But my suspicion is that it will get done at some point. But Sasha may disagree.
Mm. Well, I think there was reports of his agent flying in. I mean, all various sizes of contracts and stuff. But I think this is a situation where Liverpool have to break whatever wage structure there is and keep him because, the guy's. Klopp after the game said the best player not just in the league or the club is best player in the world, and certainly it looks like it at the moment. And I think also when he comes out against you as a defender, you know what you're up against, and I think that sort of plays on people's confidence. But also I would add one thing. I expected, I know like previous 18 months were completely messed up, but I expected this Liverpool front line to peak last season, the way they're going up, and then now they're getting to 29-30. But I saw a stat from Andrew Beasley on Twitter. So in the first 11 games, all competitions, over the last few seasons, the front three, Mane, Firmino, Salah, scored 13-10, 13-12, and this season it's 22. And they are playing together, like the way they're effectively playing together at the moment is brilliant. But you have to remember that Firmino has been injured, he's been out of the side, and now he came in. He did two jobs as well. Okay, maybe Watford didn't make it too difficult for him, but he did sit at sort of the tip of the midfield diamond, but he was also there to poach very much a hat-trick, very much in the style of Dirk Kuyt. I mean, I think the total yardage must have been around 10, but he was there to tap them in. And so I think it's his second hat-trick for Liverpool. And given that Jota is to come back as well, it certainly looks like that front line is very, very healthy.
Sadio Mane as well, Firmino with the hat-trick, but Sadio Mane with his 100th goal in the Premier League, the third African player to reach that tally after Mo Salah and Didier Drogba. He's also the third Premier League player to reach 100 goals without any of them being penalties. Do you know who the other two were, Adrian?
Oh, no. You've put me on the spot there.
Sasha
no.
does, I think.
Go on, Sash.
Solez and Emil Heskey.
Indeed. All right. Ben Foster in trouble with Watford fans after it had emerged that he'd actually captained Mo Salah in his fantasy team before this match.
That's obviously very funny, but that is going to become an issue at some point, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It doesn't look a
Leeds,
great
we
look.
Saw,
And then you watch the game and you see the Salah goal and you think, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, do you know what, though? Didn't he put off a couple of good saves?
He did.
Heading towards the top corner, denying
himself points.
He
had a perfectly decent game. So.
Ben Foster is a decent fantasy manager as well, and it was the right thing. Yeah. To do, but anyway.
Maybe it was a slight on what he'd seen of the new gaffer on the training pitch because, I mean, that defensive performance was as bad as I've seen from Watford for many years. It screamed to me, we don't know what the manager is asking us to do. That's what that performance looked to me. So, got a lot of work to do.
Early doors, of course, only one game, but they did flirt enticingly with setting a new record for lowest ever possession in a Premier League game. Current all-time low for that is 17.1% by Swansea against Man City in 2018. Watford in the first half were only around 16%, but a second half recovery took it up to a whopping 23.2%. So anyway, there you go. Swansea's record remains intact. Sasha, meantime, you had got on the train down to Brentford for Chelsea's 1-0 win over the Bees. A Napoleonic, a valiantly so, a performance from Brentford's finest under Thomas Frank.
Yeah, I run out of compliments week after week whenever I watch Brentford play. And this was
Are you getting turned? Sam?
No, I'm not getting turned, but I'm full of admiration. You have to admire people's craft when they do
Sasha,
your job really well.
Is the ideal when Klopp leaves, Thomas Frank takes over? That's what you're pushing for here.
Thomas Frank is part of the system. And I think they're all part of a system there. It's like, you know, when you had that Eintracht Frankfurt front line, they go elsewhere, they're no longer part of the system, it doesn't look as good. I think a lot of these players are looking as impressively as they are because of the system. And I thought that here, it was very curious because I think Frank drew some conclusions from the Liverpool game, which they drew 3-3, but could have lost 6-3. There was a lot of chances conceded. And I think what they did for the first, let's say, 65 minutes, okay, it was 3-5-2 against 3-5-2, they paid a lot of attention to the Chelsea midfield, particularly Nyogo on plays like Kovacic and Loftus-Cheek. So I think there was a lot there, even though probably they wouldn't admit it after the game, but about containment of Chelsea, and particularly of Chelsea midfield. And Chelsea did very well here. And also Chelsea, I thought Tuchel did a great thing with Chilwell, because there was a few times in the first half I was looking up thinking, oh yeah, Chilwell's at left, sort of on the left wing here. Yeah, that's fine. And suddenly, where is Chilwell? Why is he on the edge of the box? Hang on, he's winning knockdowns next to Lukaku for Werner to put a chance over. And I was sitting there going, oh my God, he's drifting into that space. And then that's exactly where he scored from. Mm. And then what happens, and then Frank waits. He waits. And then, as Napoleon famously said, never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake. Because I think Tuchel made a mistake. Eventually, I think he'd got to about 65 and he thought, right, let's finish these guys off. So he takes off Kovacic, he puts on Mount, goes to a 3-4-3. Frank switches immediately and the game goes direct. And this is what happened against Liverpool as well. I think Liverpool played into this as well. They went, we don't need extra midfielders, and they went direct. So I think Tuchel messed up his own plan, played into Frank's hands, and you could see last 20 minutes, Chelsea were absolutely battered. I mean, this is European champions. This is a Champions League contender, title contender. They couldn't get out. Their XG second half was like 0.02. Mount was ineffectual. Havertz came on, was ineffectual. It was like, I was asking Tuchel after the game, so, you know, last 20, oh, you make subs, they're not working. What's happening? He was like, yeah, it's just chaos. And then sometimes momentum of the game shifts and you can't really, like, it's nothing wrong that subs are doing. You just can't shift it back. He was going nuts on the bench as well. And, like, you could see that. But effectively, Frank had him right there and there was nothing he could do to affect the game. And also, like, it got absurd because last, like, 10 minutes, they were just basically chucking in high balls into the box because I think they realized we're much bigger than these guys and they were winning all the headers. Mendy couldn't come off his line. And it was basically Mendy, like these desperate saves. He did absolutely superbly. He is currently making me eat my words, the words that I said on the spot in May around him perhaps not being good enough. And he was absolutely brilliant. So I think, like, my notes the last 20 minutes is basically Mendy, Chalobah off the line, Mendy, and the last fingertip save from Nyoga was absolutely excellent. What a performance from him. But as Tuchel said after the game, 70 minutes, very strong. Last 20, lucky.
Yeah, they got away with it. Part of the reason for that, of course, is Brian Mbeumo hitting the post again twice. Officially the unluckiest man in football, depending on whether you rate hitting the post as being bad at your job or just unfortunate. He's hit the woodwork anyway 6 times this season. That's more than any of the other 19 Premier League clubs have. Crikey.
Yeah, I mean, Brentford were phenomenal in that last 20 minutes. Without, like, as Sasha refers to, they didn't really create chances as just sort of toss a coin in the air and work out that was going to be good enough for chances to kind of happen to them rather than to be created. But it was such good fun to watch. And I know Sasha said it to start with, but they are the best team to watch in the Premier League now. They've taken that mantle off Leeds from last season and every game is brilliant.
Mm. Magnificent. Chelsea, anyway, hanging on to the win and top spot thus in the Premier League after 8 rounds. They're 1 point ahead of Liverpool, who are 1 point ahead of Man City, who had the 2-0 win over Burnley. It wasn't 5-0 this time. Still, though, probably the most routine outcome of the weekend. They've had a victory in each of their last 9 games against the Clarets, with an aggregate scoreline now of 32 goals for and just the one against. Anything you want to take out of this game before we get on to the other Manchester side? Raheem Sterling, perhaps, with his third Premier League start of the season? Or maybe somebody wants to talk about Burnley and then say, they'll be fine?
I was just going to talk about Cole Palmer, who came off the bench for Manchester City and then scored a hat-trick for the under-23s later the same day, which is, I think, Mark Hughes famously did that by playing 2 games in the same day. But, he's 19 years old and he's an attacking midfielder at Manchester City, and you sort of worry for him in the fact that Phil Foden's already taking that academy graduate attacking midfielder slot, so he might have to go on loan, but he's already broken into the England under-21s and he does look a heck of a talent, it must be said. I think Guardiola clearly didn't want Foden to go out on loan, but I think he might well compromise on Palmer, and you know, a kind of high-end championship loan in January would probably make some sense.
Or the Bundesliga.
Yes, the Bundesliga, please.
Yeah. On that, I just love his attitude, because young players could easily be forgiven for getting ahead of themselves, couldn't they? I'm part of the first team squad here. I'm on the bench. I'm not just on the bench. He's brought me on. This is where I am now. And you know, the under-23s, oh, glad I don't have to play against Leicester tonight. You know, I can just put my feet up and bask in the glow of getting a Premier League appearance. And that didn't come into his thinking at all. It was like, look, I only played for a minute. Can I go and join my mates and do the business for the under-23s? I love that attitude, the hunger, and it really, really bodes well. And look, if I'm Pep Guardiola, a member of the coaching staff there, he's gone up in my estimations by making that choice. Not because he scored a hat-trick, just because he wanted to get involved. He wanted to muck in with the under-23s. Great stuff.
Brilliant. What about Raheem Sterling? Should he go on a short-term loan to the Championship or the Bundesliga?
Let's talk about a Barcelona loan in the newspapers this morning. I think it's a situation that Manchester City have kind of engineered themselves, in that he's a player who has always needed confidence, and City have effectively bought a £100 million player in his best position. He's playing through the middle, which has never been his best role, unless City are able to do that thing where they get to the byline and he's 6 yards out. But they aren't really playing like that with because Bernardo Silva's dominating the game from the kind of right-hand side of the midfield three, and De Bruyne from the right-hand side as well. So, yeah, I feel for him a bit, but, yeah, he's not in any form. And I don't know, I feel like City need a number nine for him to come back into form, because otherwise he's just going to have to play that central role while Ferran Torres is injured.
With Raheem at the moment, yeah, he's desperately lacking rhythm and confidence. And yeah, I think that the Grealish signing will have knocked his confidence, because it's like they have deliberately targeted a player they didn't really need, and he plays in my position. I've been there. When the manager goes and signs someone in your position, it crushes you. You can't let it crush you for long. You have to get over it and fight. But that sinking feeling when you know that the club have invested big money in someone that plays your role, it sows that seed of doubt. And if you have a doubt that the manager doesn't love you in the same way that he used to, it can impact.
Can imagine. Mm. Well, shaking Burnley's confidence is the fact that they have failed to win any of their opening 8 league games this season. Of course, last season they failed to win any of their opening 7 league games, and they were all right. And probably there will be this time too. Next up, they'll be having a trip to Southampton. OK, let's get on next to the drama at the King Power, where a lacklustre Leicester were facing a Man United side that were unstoppable on the road. And that's next.
I'm David Ornstein, and you can read my in-depth interview with the former Arsenal, Chelsea and now very much current AC Milan striker Olivier Giroud on The Athletic right now. Giroud tells me about his battle to prove people wrong, literally since birth, 9 years in the Premier League and his relationships with Arsene Wenger, Frank Lampard and Thomas Tuchel, the highs and lows of France, yes, that Karim Benzema rivalry, and plenty more besides. And if you fancy seeing the interview, and come on, why wouldn't you want to watch a 15-minute video of Olivier Giroud shot in the fashion capital of Italy? You can find it on the Athletic UK YouTube channel.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. That way, you won't feel like a massive mug, you know, like the one that was floating down the Tyne whenever Squillionaires Newcastle concede that inevitable last-minute equaliser. Pre-match bet builders only. Get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Max free bet £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. It's over 18s only. And please, gamble responsibly.
In from Tielemans, across to the back, where Daka has scrambled in, and as the game goes into injury time, Leicester have won it for sure.
Leicester 4, Man United 2. Before anyone starts grumbling about Ollie and United and all that, let's first of all say 40 shots in this game and some absolutely incredible goals.
And two goals in which I will watch again and again and not be able to work out whether they were deliberate or not. In firstly, Youri Tielemans.
Deliberate.
Crush.
Deliberate.
Fine.
Happy.
I want you to be right, Adrian, so I'm happy for you to be right. And then Jamie Vardy's shanked. I mean, it wasn't even a shin. It was sort of just below the knee, I think, that he kind of connected
was
with
it?
The ball on that one. Yeah, it was really
like
high.
It in. Yeah.
But it goes top corner, so yeah. Yes, I'm still happy to enjoy it.
Right. Mason Greenwood with a pretty special goal at open proceedings, and then Tielemans with that audacious equaliser. Then in the second half, there was this mad five-minute stretch. Soyuncu puts Leicester in front. The returning Marcus Rashford, taking time out from his other commitment, made it 2-2. Just 54 seconds later, though, Jamie Vardy whips that one in off whichever part of his leg it was, and the Foxes are back in front. And then Patson Daka adds a fourth in time added on. Patson Daka, stats fans will have noticed, becoming the first Zambian to score in the Premier League. And this coming on the same day that the Premier League had seen its first Albanian goal, Armando Broja.
From Slough.
But playing for Albania. And that was, of course, in Saints' win over Leeds. Right. Hey, Leicester look alive again. What's happening there?
Very impressive. I think that when Leicester press with intensity, when they're bold and they get in the faces of opposition teams, they are a real handful to contain. I thought that the team selection actually from Brendan Rodgers kind of sent out a signal of intent because he shook it up. Lookman had been playing pretty well before the international break. Barnes was decent at Selhurst Park, setting up a goal, but he dropped them and he brought in out of form Maddison. But I think what he wanted to do was go with the two up front and the one in behind. And he had a plan. He went in with the plan that they clearly worked on. And he'd pumped the players up, I think, for the game. And it was great. I thought Maddison was scampering around everywhere, particularly in the first half. He was great. Ian Acho, the way that he robbed Maguire, set the tone, didn't it? That was wonderful from him. And they just carried it on. I think when you're front guys, set the tone by basically making life as uncomfortable as possible for defenders. It just uplifts everybody in the stadium. They're very good to watch when they play that way. Mm. Albeit, they were helped by an utterly dreadful Manchester United performance without the ball. It was as bad as it gets in terms of laziness and the way that they were disorganised, out of possession. Nobody seemed to know what they were supposed to be doing. And that is, I'm afraid, a direct reflection on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's coaching.
Right.
There are only so many get-out-of-jail-free cards you can get. He's got to prove, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, that he's more than just a caretaker of a happy dressing room. Yeah, he's a good guy. He can look after these big egos. And that is a big part of management. But you also need a plan. You need an identity. You need to be able to make a tactical decision that changes things for the better. And when was the last time any of that happened?
United have only taken 1 point from the last 9 available in the Premier League. If that 29-game unbeaten run was kind of the last fig leaf for Solskjaer, what exactly are we looking at now?
Yeah, I mean, I, the reaction of people who still want to defend him, and that's partly for emotional reasons, and therefore you can't really criticise that. But there's now going to become this notion that the players have downed tools, and therefore it's on the players. Adrian will know better than me, but to my mind, that's basically a myth. It might happen occasionally. It might happen with one or two individuals at a club, but it doesn't happen en masse. What might happen is that players, subconsciously otherwise, feel a bit demotivated that they have excellent players around them, and yet there doesn't seem to be a plan to get the best out of them. And that's the same in any industry in the world. If you're in a company where you don't think things are being kind of connected together for everyone to move in the right direction, it makes you feel low, and it makes you less likely to perform at the highest level. And I think that's what's happening at Manchester United. And I'm actually vaguely reassured by it, in the fact that it's nice that you can have all these brilliant individual players but can still not be very good at getting results unless there is an identity, unless there is a really capable coach, because that kind of warms me a little bit, because that means that managers do still make a difference, that it's not just who has the best players wins. The reports say that Manchester United are still happy with Solskjaer and that they're going to give him more time, but that to me seems nothing but a fool's errand, if I'm honest. I think it's just a clawing at some kind of romantic notion that doesn't really exist in reality.
Mm. Sasha, bearing in mind that we have this chat pretty much every week. Yeah.
Harry Maguire didn't look like he should have been playing. He got caught on the ball badly twice, so that's error for one, directly led to one of the goals. And then he doesn't step up once Ayuncu scores. And he's totally asleep. When Daka is behind him to bundle in the fourth, and not just because he's in the way, he's in there. He doesn't go for the ball. He can go for the ball. So it looked to me like Maguire shouldn't have been playing. And also, talking of fig leaves, they haven't played any of the big six so far. Oof. Next six, five of them are against the big six. I mean, whatever you might say about Arsenal and Spurs, those guys are going to give them difficult games. So I think in the next couple of months, we could really find out what this United team are made of.
Well, in the next couple of weeks, you've got Liverpool coming up this weekend, you've got Spurs, and then you've got Man City. And sandwiched in between all of those, you've also got Atalanta twice in the Champions League. Atalanta, who this weekend had probably their best result of the season so far, 4-1 win away at Empoli, with Josip Iličić looking like he wants to play football again, getting a brace, second one, cutting in, got 1-2 with a teammate, and then curling one into the far corner. How much of a challenge are Atalanta going to provide at Old Trafford on Wednesday? Well, after Sunday night's Gulazzo Live, James Horncastle gave us his thoughts on the challenge for United.
As much as people say, well, if Atalanta conceded fewer goals, they might actually win something, this style has got them into the Champions League 3 years in a row. It has made them the best Italian team in this competition in that time. They've gone further than anybody else. Remember the quarterfinals in Portugal against PSG when they were 1-0 up and they went down to 10 men because they'd used all their subs. I think Freuler got injured, and then Marquinhos and Choupo-Moting put them out in stoppage time. This style, they'll stick with it at Old Trafford, and I think as much as it may play into United's hands, when it really works, there's nothing you can really do to stop it, because they will be up and at United in a pressing style that will play at Champions League tempo, which is not what a lot of other Serie A teams do, I would say. And as I mentioned, they've lost Papu Gomez, who obviously had his differences with Gasperini this time last year, ended up being sold in January. They don't have the same maybe sense of invention, creativity as they did at that time, but they still can score lots of goals, particularly when Iličić is back to his best. He's lost the belly that he came back from pre-season with. Muriel's had his injuries and ups and downs. I think having those two guys back, and Zapata, for example, who didn't play or didn't start in Empoli, having those guys all fit and firing is pretty worrying, even though, and United should take heart from this, Atalanta are decimated by injuries in other positions. Their flying wing-backs are injured. Gosens, Hans Hattebourg, one of their best centre-backs, Jim City, he's injured. Toloi went off in the first half against Empoli. Mattia Pessina, one of the members of that Italy European Championship winning team, scored against Wales, scored against Austria in the knockout stages. Those guys either face a last-minute fitness test or will definitely be out. So it's a very interesting mix. You have, on the one hand, Atalanta scoring four goals again. Haven't seen them do that for a while. Ilicic scoring twice. He hasn't scored a multiple since before the pandemic, when he was probably the MVP in Serie A. And Muriel, who, remember, if you look at XG, goals per minute, I think only Lewandowski was matching him or beating him last year. So they'll be a real threat to United.
Well, for a team that lost to Young Boys and then only narrowly squeaked past Villarreal, sounds like it could be a tough night in prospect. I think one of the things with United, you're saying that they seem to be happy with Solskjaer, is that while the money's rolling in, it's not an issue. However, were their Champions League campaign to be curtailed for the second season in a row, that might push people towards decisions.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, to put what Sasha was saying about the weakness of the opposition they face into context, I think those four supposed title challengers, United, City, Liverpool and Chelsea, have played 22 games against non-big six teams this season. And in total, they've only dropped 14 points, which kind of reflects the inequalities of the Premier League. But Man United account for 10 of those 14 points. So we've seen Solskjaer perform better against big clubs, but they did also lose 4-2 at home to Liverpool at the end of last season. So I think that's a bit of a stretch. But yeah, I think you're right. The Champions League is the one, because fallout from the group stage again there. And yeah, they're in a situation where they are becoming mediocre, and that will not be allowed to stand, I don't think.
All right, currently second in the group behind Atalanta. We'll see what Wednesday does to that. Well done anyway for Leicester, picking up only their second win in their last eight in all competitions. And next up, let's talk about some other stuff, including Saturday's remarkable game at Villa Park.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Sasha, you a fan of angry goalkeepers?
Whatever works for you, I think, basically. I mean, okay. Liverpool currently don't have an angry goalkeeper, and he is perfectly competent.
I see. Did you catch Aaron McCary's performance in the Irish Premiership? This in the game between Glentoran and Coleraine. Glentoran were 2-1 up with 10 minutes to go, but then Coleraine equalised, at which point Glen's keeper Aaron McCary runs over to his teammate Bobby Burns and knocks him to the ground angrily before dragging him up by the shirt for seconds, at which point teammates intervene, as does the referee, and sends off the keeper. He was, I think, furious with Burns because he'd given the ball away on the halfway line, leading to Coleraine's equaliser. But still, pretty extraordinary stuff, Adrian.
Very extraordinary, yeah. I've never experienced it, I've got to say, in terms of in a match, one of my teammates striking a colleague. But I've got a lot of experience of angry keepers. They just always come for you. I've got to say that my suspicion throughout my career, and nothing has really changed on this, my suspicion is that the vast majority of angry goalkeepers do it for show. They do it for show. That is part of it. I just think they feel like they need to be seen to be, you know, rattling some cages. And I just don't like, individuals being sort of put up there in the spotlight. That was all down to you. Because it's happened to me before where a keeper's sort of come
to
me.
So you think the keepers are right to shift the blame onto everybody else?
No, I just don't think they should be putting all the blame. It's not down to them to decide who was culpable,
right,
for a concession particularly, because you look at each goal, there could be two or three mistakes, four or five mistakes. Yet if a keeper goes and you know, picks on that one guy, everyone just assumes it's on them, and I think that's wrong.
I think a lot of people just look at it and think, well, the keeper's basically feeling a bit awkward. I'm a big fan of calm keepers myself. I used to love Gigi Buffon for this reason, but of later career, Gigi Buffon started getting very angry indeed. But great shout from Sasha about Alisson.
But he has possibly nothing to complain about, given what who he plays behind. But I think also with keepers, I think part of it is also defense mechanism, because I think as a goalkeeper, you often feel like they're all pointing at you, as in, A, why was that the mistake, or why didn't you rescue us this time? So, I think it comes both ways, but I think, a lot of it is because we just feel defensive sometimes.
Yeah, it's like when you stub your toe on a large thing that you yourself have left there, and who the bloody hell left that there?
That's exactly it. It is exactly it. Yeah. So, but look, he paid the price for that. I mean, that is idiotic in the extreme, getting yourself sent off for whacking your mate, isn't it?
And one wonders what other repercussions there might be, because it points to a slightly awkward atmosphere within the team as well. But anyway, that was Glentoran against Coleraine. Let's talk about what happened at Villa Park. Not sure if Emi Martinez would have been shouting at his teammates. Remarkable finish to this game. Wolves were 2-0 down with just 10 minutes left after Villa had scored through Danny Ings and then John McGinn. And yet the visitors emerged 3-2 winners, not what, quarter of an hour later?
Yeah, I mean, people will offer more analysis on Wolves than me, but I kind of saw this weekend as the luck of football, because I didn't think those last 10 minutes were any different to Brentford Chelsea's last 10 minutes. The difference is that, you know, the ball hits Cody and goes in. There's a free kick that hits target and goes in. And I think sometimes that's just the way it goes. When a team builds up ahead of steam, they will create, you know, Wolves did the same thing. They basically launched the ball into the box and hoped that chances would happen. And chances did happen, and theirs happened to go in the net. I mean, Villa did slightly fall apart, no doubt. But that's what I love about football, is that you can replay the same thing 100 times and one thing will happen 50 times and another thing will happen 50 times.
100%. What is it that Premier League defenders aren't used to? It's balls being hoisted into the box. I mean, a League Two side or a League One side, all day, every day. It's not, you know, it's what we do. But in the Premier League, everything's on the deck these days. Everything is so pretty, and it's about movement and speed and skill. I'm amazed that it doesn't happen more often. Just cause a bit of chaos. That's what Brentford do. Daniel's absolutely bang on. That's all Wolves did, cause chaos. And Villa were like, whoa, what do we do here? Started to panic. And yeah, it was. I love it. I love turnarounds like that.
And I think this would have been a game where Emi Martinez would have been completely right to be really quite angry with his defence, because they just couldn't clear their lines. They couldn't step out. And so you could see the first two goals. It just balls keep on coming back. It's not the first attack. I think it's like a second or third wave, and they just can't escape. And I think eventually, people lose their bearings. But also, I think Wolves scored at a good time, because they scored with 10 minutes to go. That builds up a bit of momentum. That sows a bit of doubt in defenders' mind. Then they score with 5 minutes left. And I think at that stage, you know, Villa are properly panicking. All right, the final goal is lucky. But I think, I agree with the guys that sometimes the ball just drops right for you. And it didn't drop right for Brentford, and it dropped right for Wolves.
Certainly did. Wow, that's their fourth win in five games. Three Premier League wins in a row for Bruno Lage, who deserves credit, although he said, I got away with it this time with his attacking substitutions, really to key that torrent of chances towards the end. First home defeat of the season for Villa, who are having a pretty inconsistent time of it. They won at Old Trafford. They outplayed Chelsea, although they didn't get the result. And then this, one of those seasons, I guess. The yet-to-win club in the Premier League is now down to just three sides, after Southampton picked up their first 3 points of this campaign at home to Leeds. Mention Armando Breuer getting the goal on his first Premier League start. He's on loan from Chelsea, I read. He also scored the winner for Albania against Hungary during the international break. Woof.
He actually scored two winners against Hungary in 2 months, because he scored the winner back in September as well. He's been quite effective coming on as a sub for Albania.
Wow.
To be honest, I haven't been across Breuer before, and so I was listening to his post-match interview, and I was like, huh, what are you from? And obviously he's born in Slough to Albanian parents. But he's like his goals for Albania were absolutely quality, very direct, powerful shot and everything. And here I think maybe this is a striker that Southampton need to finally replace Danny Ings, someone who is sort of directly goes for goal. And I thought he looked pretty impressive. And he made a huge difference because I think he really put Leeds on the back foot.
I wonder if Hasenhüttl picked him instead of Adam Armstrong for this game. I wonder if he might consider a kind of more of a little and large partnership and have Armstrong running off, Broha holding up the ball, because he kind of played Nathan Redmond off Broha on Saturday. But he's going to have to play Armstrong because, you know, he was the big summer signing to replace Ings, and Brejo is not going to score every week. So I wonder if he might go for that front two and try and make something out of that.
Great to see that from Broha for Albania and Saints. What about Leeds? Things we keep expecting them to pick up, but as yet, not really.
No, it's as weak a Leeds team as we've seen, I think, under Bielsa. But that said, if you take out Phillips, Rafinha and Bamford out of your team, it's not going to be anywhere near as strong. But yeah, look, three shots in the game to Southampton's 19. It is very, very disappointing. Yeah, very poor from Leeds, who, for one, let's put it in base terms, don't seem to be running as hard or as fast or with as much zest as they did before. Who knows what that is down to, but they're not. I think this was the first game since Bielsa managed in the Premier League with Leeds that his team have been outrun by the opposition. And I guess if you're going to be outrun by a team, it's no surprise that it's one coached by Hasenhüttl, who obviously demands, you know, great work rate.
Well, for now, Leeds sit precariously just above the bottom three, although they are 3 points clear of the drop and 1 point behind a trio of sides, Saints themselves, Watford and Palace, who could improve their position Monday evening when they visit Arsenal at the Emirates. And indeed, with a win, Palace would take Arsenal's place in 13th. Crikey. Adrian, this game may have taken place by the time listeners hear this, but you're going along to the game, aren't you? You care to hazard a prediction?
Yeah. I think Palace are very capable of making it a competitive game. Look, it was a reality check for Arsenal at Brighton, very much second best in that match. So yeah, can they assert their authority? Can they control the game against Crystal Palace? It's a game that in the past they would have controlled and dominated, but not that sure whether that will happen this time around. Arsenal are not a possession team at the moment. Palace are. Patrick Vieira, who is sure to get a great welcome, has done a great job, I think, with some really tough fixtures. He's done a great job at remoulding the style very quickly. Here's one for you. They average 52 more passes per game, Crystal Palace, than Arsenal. I mean, this is Palace. Palace, who barely strung up any passes together at all if it wasn't on the counter-attack under Roy Hodgson. So he's really revamped their style. And yeah, I think they can give the Gunners a tough game.
That's what bringing in a former Arsenal midfielder as your manager will do for you. Oh, no, hang on. Oh, well, anyway. Well, we'll see what happens on that on Monday. But anyway, you mentioned Brighton, and they were the other team that was in action this weekend. It was a goalless draw away at Carrow Road, but one that has them in the top four, Brighton, somehow in the Champions League position still. That's their second 0-0, second 0-0 as well for Norwich 2. Norwich is an interesting thing. Not only have never won this season, they've never even taken the lead. They've had 34 shots since they last scored a goal.
That's probably 33 though, right? Because we can't classify Josh Sargent's miss of the season contender as a shot, can we? I mean, are we in agreement?
If it doesn't reach the goal, is it the shot? You can't block shots, but it wasn't.
Okay, this was last on Match of the Day, and I may not have been paying full attention at this point. What did Josh Sargent do?
He rounded the keeper. So it was a ball hoisted over the top. The keeper comes out of the box. He goes around Sanchez. And, okay, he's 25 yards out, but it is an open goal. He does have ages to put it into the back of the net. And in essence, he just produced one of the wimpiest efforts I've seen in Premier League history. He wouldn't be in my squad next week. It's that bad. I just think he's you're paid to score goals. That is the most presentable opportunity of the season. And
sounds like an angry manager having a go at angry goalkeepers here.
Yeah, well, I mean, come on. It was a shocker, wasn't it?
Yeah,
because I think a defender eventually clears it, but the ball's pretty much stopped quite a few yards short of the line. And yeah, it's just
look terrible. Having said that, Daniel Farke, can you see? Can you imagine him shouting at people?
You can't imagine Daniel Farke shouting at anyone.
I just every time I see him and hear him talk, I am like, I just struggle to imagine it. I mean, he would speak to me for 30 seconds. I just want to hug him and stuff. And if he started shouting at me, like, I'd be like, this is it. This is the end of the world. I just don't even want to contemplate that. So poor Josh Sargent, if he gets shouted at by Daniel Farke, he's in a dark place.
I see. All right. Well, Norwich generally in a bit of a dark place at the moment. But we'll see if next weekend brings better things. Very shortly, we'll be talking about what's happening midweek. Sasha's got some interesting details on Leicester's next opponents. First of all, though, let's get some odds from Paddy Power. Carl Monaghan joins producer Charlie.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, listener. Delete as appropriate. And happy Champions League match week 3 to you all. Lots to look forward to. Carl Monaghan is fresh from driving the Paddy Power boat down the Tyne. He knows where it's at. We're talking at Letico and at Atalanta. Liverpool are off to the Wander on Tuesday, and they don't have a good record against the Spanish champions.
No, they failed to win, Charlie, Liverpool on their last three trips to the Wander, as Diego Simeone seems to have developed the knack for numbing the Liverpool attack when they visit the Spanish capital. But with Salah the hottest property in Europe at the moment, the Atletico defence will be kept on their toes for sure. Jurgen Klopp's men are also boosted by the return of Alisson and Fabinho, who missed the Watford game after the pair were away on international duty. This is going to be a tight game, you feel, though. The Paddy Power traders, Charlie, have priced it up as follows. Atletico Madrid 21-10, the draw is 23-10, and Liverpool are the 5-4 favourites. A score draw appeals for sure at 16-5, as there is plenty of ability in both sides' attacks. Salah is causing havoc at the moment, while the La Liga outfit have Luis Suarez and Antoine Griezmann leading their line. And if you fancy a certain bitey 34-year-old Uruguayan to score against his former club, go right ahead. Barca only got the treatment from Suarez a few weeks back.
Then it's Man United against Atalanta on Wednesday night at Old Trafford. Will there be yet more last-minute drama with United in the Champions League, Carl?
Well, Charlie, Man United fans will be hoping they can avoid Fergie time drama in this one, as the loss out in Switzerland to Young Boys makes this a must-win game for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in terms of qualification from the group. Atalanta have been consistent performers in the last few seasons, to be fair, and despite the fact that they lie 11th in Serie A at present, 10 points off the leaders, they are a side who will be no pushovers for the Red Devils. Rather alarmingly for United, Atalanta have been the top scorers in Serie A for the last three seasons, scoring a whopping 265 goals in that time. Wow. But the piece of form that will give United cause for concern, Charlie, is that Atalanta went to Villarreal and left with a 2-2 draw in round one, the same Villarreal who played United off the park for the majority of the game at Old Trafford a few weeks back. In terms of the match betting, Manchester United are the favourites at 4-5 to win it. The draw is 14-5 and the Italians are 3-1. With Varane already ruled out, a United win and both teams to score looks the way to play it at 2-1.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It is over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Totally Football League show. Adrian, you're on that this week. It's out a little bit later on Monday. Duncan Alexander will be hoping you guys talk about Wickham making their best start to a season in their history. And I will be hoping that you will try and match Neil Warnock's analysis of his own side Borough's fortunes, to wit.
My team is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
What?
I mean, it's up there with the Josh Sargent miss as sounds one of the like most shameful sort of, acts of the weekend.
Sounds like a sort of last of the summer wine, deep south.
Yeah. Wow.
You're right.
Now, also, Totally Football Show European Edition will be out early doors Tuesday. It'll be a packed one as well with Rafa, James Horncastle again, Julian Laurens and Alvaro Romeo, because it's a busy week. You've got the Champions League matches. Touched on one of those already. Who are Man City playing?
Club Bruges.
Oh, they're against Bruges. Right, and then Liverpool, Sash?
At Atletico Madrid, who had the weekend off.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because that was the patient zero game at Anfield. This time, with Britain being the Petri dish of Europe, we've got a chance to kind of export our virus back to them.
I will be going to hopefully not export my virus, but I will be there in
Excellent. And Chelsea play Malmo. Daniel, have a great time in Madrid.
I've got a nice week. I'm doing that, and then I'm doing Barcelona Dynamo Kiev on the Wednesday and Betis Leverkusen on Thursday.
Crikey. Oh.
Wow. You can tell who's in charge now, can't you? Yeah. I think I'll do these games. I'll go to Spain.
I should stress that it's more that if I'm going to go away, I might as well go for three games than one and
somewhere very, very nice. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice.
31 degrees in Seville today, so don't worry too much.
Is that right? 21? Yeah.
31.
31?
Yeah, apparently. Madness.
That is mad. Now, Europa League fixtures have been a bit rearranged this week. You've got one on Tuesday and one on Wednesday as well, which is troubling. It's all because of, I mean, you call it fixture congestion. It's the fact that Rangers are playing on Thursday in the Europa League and Celtic therefore can't play at home, and they can't play next week because you've got the climate change conference taking place in Glasgow then. So they have to, they've shifted their game with Ferencvaros to Tuesday afternoon, a 3:30 kickoff, which is a challenging one, I would imagine, for many of their supporters. The other game that's been moved, and this is because Spartak Moscow can't play at home because Lokomotiv Moscow are in action against Galatasaray on Thursday. So Spartak will be hosting Leicester at 3:30 again on Wednesday. Crikey, 3:30 on Wednesday, that's UK time, is it?
Yeah, so it's 5:30 in Moscow. It's a bit nicer. It's 30% capacity in the stadium, so they can have up to 13,000 fans.
Right.
But looking at Leicester against United, I'm fearing again for Spartak. Having said that, I feared for Spartak before they went to Naples. Mm. And they got themselves a lucky break because Luc Mario Rui got sent off in the first half. Then they hooked Insigne, tried to play with 10, and Spartak exploited that opportunity in the second half and won 3-2 against, you know, flying Napoli side. This is one of Spartak's finest and, I have to say, most unexpected wins, like probably in the European history. And the thing is, Spartak, as I mentioned before, are a club in a bit of a mess. New manager, very much up and down performances. At the weekend, they had a derby against Dynamo Moscow. They were 2-0 down. And I think what's worrying, especially looking at the way Leicester play, they were getting cuts, like sliced, like just down the middle. Konstantin Tukavin scored the second, 19-year-old. One of the perhaps promising young stars in Russia, he scored the second, could have made it 3-0 with 7 minutes to go. Pulled that one over, and Sparta grabbed their chance with two very late headers. So 2-2, but, you know, in terms of confidence in defence, you know, it doesn't fill me with confidence at all. Having said that, what is wrong with Brendan Rodgers and European football? He just can't do Europe. Like, I find it so baffling. This was at Liverpool, this was at Leicester. I just find it really odd. And also, sorry, at Celtic as well. Those absolutely horrendous defeats. I find it really odd that someone like him, he just doesn't quite hack it in the European competitions. Mm. So maybe this is Spartak's chance. Obviously Leicester have had quite a poor start so far in the first two games. So maybe Spartak have a chance around that.
Right.
A couple of other things around Spartak as well. There's going to be a minute silence before the game because of the tragedy that happened on the 20th of October 1982. There was Spartak played Haarlem and there was a late goal and kind of fans went back and forth and there was gates closed and the steps were slippery. 66 people died and 700 were injured. So that's Spartak's big sort of tragedy. But on slightly nicer note, they had a presentation before the game on against Dinamo. Nikita Simonian is 95 and Nikita Simonian is a man from a long gone era. I mean, he retired in 1959. He won titles with Spartak in the 50s. He was part of the Soviet team that won the Melbourne Olympics in 1956, like Soviet Union's first major trophy. He's also the guy, for example, many people didn't pick up on this, but when Hungary recently reopened their stadium, he took the kickoff. And the reason for that was he played at the opening game of the NEP Stadion in 1953 against Honved. And I think he scored a tap and Spartak lost 3-2. And, the guys who scored for Honved, it was Božić, it was Kočić. So he's like, he connects us with an age that has long disappeared. And, you know, he's around. He had a bit of a managerial career after he finished, won a couple of titles with Spartak, including stopping the first reincarnation of, you know, pressing Dynamo Kiev. And then he's been sort of the grand old man of Soviet and then Russian football. He worked in the USSR team with Lobanovsky, which was quite unusual given that Lobanovsky always sort of saw Moscow with a bit of suspicion. But, you know, Simonyan was one of those politically savvy guys, get on with many people. And then he kind of stayed in Russian football. And, you know, he would, until recently, you know, he'd run on and take kickoffs and stuff, and he'd run off the pitch, guy in his 90s. So it was really nice touch. And it's sort of heartening to see that he's still around because, as I said, like, he connects us to an age of football which is gone.
All right. Did they play Nikita when they did the presentation?
I don't know what Nikita is.
Oh, Nikita, is it cold?
No, I don't believe they did.
You don't know that song?
I don't know that song.
That Elton John Stone Cold classic?
Nope. Nope. I'm going to have to go and listen to it. I mean, but
don't, in, Sasha, for don't. Your sake. Right. Yeah. It's not one of his best, to be fair. The video.
When did it come out? Or was it was I still behind the Iron Curtain when it came out?
No, I don't think so. This was kind of. This is late era Elton. Mind you, my definition of late era Elton might differ from other people's. But yeah, I can't believe you've never seen it. It's the one where she's a foxy looking Red Army officer drilling, not in that way, her kind of her troops. And Elton's kind of gazing wistfully from the other side of a checkpoint. So I guess we're still in Cold War era. It must still be kind of late 80s.
You know what must be quite confusing? Nikita is very much a male name in Russia.
Right. Well, you know, Elton, it's not going to be an issue.
That's true. That's true.
Hmm. But the video, sure, has taken a particular stance. And maybe that was because attitudes in the late 80s were different.
I'm going to have to seek this out, James.
Unexpected social commentary there.
Oh, yeah, Nikita, is it cold?
10 tin soldiers in a row. Is that right?
Yeah, counting your 10 soldiers in a row. Mm. Oh, Nikita, you'll never know. Same era as Sacrifice.
Which is
okay, that I recognise. Okay.
Right.
This has been an education, James.
And for me as well. And I'm sure for you, listener, too. What's that? You've got places to go? All right, then. We'll wrap this one up. Thank you so much, Sasha and Daniel. Have a great trip. Thank you as well, Adrian. Brilliant stuff. Look forward to reading all of your tactical breakdowns at PremierLeague.com, amongst other places. Producer Charlie, many thanks to you and you, listener. Of course, there's those other pods coming up Monday, Tuesday, etc. And then this show returns on Thursday to wrap up the Champions League fun and those early Europa League games. Do join us for that. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.